Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and you're listening to the 10 Adventures podcast. We are more than just a travel company. We are a community of active explorers who have been inspired by the outdoors. Join me as I sit down with real people to talk about their most epic adventures on this incredible planet. Welcome back to the 10 Adventures podcast. If you're into ultralight backpacking, then you've probably heard of Gossamer gear. In fact, you may even own some Gossamer gear. So I'm excited to have the founder, Glenn Van Pesky, on the podcast today. Glenn just wrote the book, Take Less, Do More, which is an autobiography that touches on his unique life, as well as shares insight into how to live a more meaningful life. Welcome to the podcast, Glenn.
Thanks, Richard.
First up, I want to congratulate you on your book. It was a great read. Fun to kind of follow along, but also there's just so much insight in there, which a lot of the outdoor books, you don't get as much insight. So you've managed to combine both, which I think is really special.
Well, I'm glad because that was my goal. I think there's plenty of excellent books on how to go lighter when you're backpacking. And I probably have a few, a little bit to add in that area. But I wanted to expose some of the larger applications of the lessons I've learned while lightening my own backpack.
So I want to ask some questions, just kind of going through the book, some things that I thought was really interesting. And the first that came through to me was the impact of the outdoors on you as a child. Can you maybe share how you got introduced and developed your love of the outdoors?
Well, we always spent time in the outside when I was growing up as a young child in Southern California. My dad had an International Harvester pickup truck, and he's also an engineer and very handy, actually a lot handier than I am, and had constructed, at least as I remember, this thing that went in the bed of the truck that had drawers for all our Coleman stove and lantern and everything. And so we would go camping at national parks. And I just remember, you know, the smell of the trees and the sun on the pine needles and the mountains. It was always a great time.
When I was reading the book, I wondered, you know, there's fewer parents that prioritize outdoor time. More kids are spending time indoors. What do you think the impact on future generations will be as they don't develop the love that you and so many other guests on the podcast developed as children for the outdoors?
You know, my kids are older, but I would say, I mean, kids today need the outdoors even more. I mean, I was growing up without cell phones, without TV, without internet. And we still got a lot of value out of the outdoors. So today, as connected and with so many screens in front of their eyes that kids have, I mean, I would say getting them outside and away from those is more important than ever.
Yeah, it's incredible the number of distractions for children and things to keep them occupied. And yet when I take my kids out backpacking, they just love it. And, you know, looking for frogs or looking for, you know, fish in mountain lakes, you know, they can be amused for an entire day without even thinking about, you know, going on YouTube or playing a video game. But it's hard to get that first step just to get them, you know, to disconnect. Get them in the van to go to the mountains is the hardest part, actually.
Yeah, it's that withdrawal. But yeah, once you do it, I mean, and the great thing about time outside is, you know, nobody's trying to sell you something. I mean, all the things you're consuming on the screens, usually there's someone trying to sell you something that you probably don't need while you're doing that. And when you're outside, it's like you're just enjoying what's there. You don't need anything more to enjoy it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I found how you founded Gossamer Gear really, really interesting because it was, you know, you're totally opposite of almost every company formation. Can you maybe start with what inspired you to make lighter gear and then maybe talk a little bit about how that evolved into a company?
Sure. Yeah, I kind of shake my head too. You know, I have friends younger who are starting companies and they're doing business plans and projections and all this kind of stuff. It's like, wow, I don't know how to do that kind of stuff. So my mom thought that every kid should leave home knowing how to cook, bake, and sew. And so all three of us kids, when we left home, knew how to do that. So when our youngest son, our oldest son, Brian, crossed over into Boy Scouts. We're in Southern California, Carlsbad area. And the Scoutmaster, who was a friend of mine I knew through Toastmasters, Reed Miller, he had just read Ray Jardine's re-release of his book, of his original book, on ultralight backpacking. And so Reed got captivated by the ultralight ethos, and he had decided he was going to hike the entire Pacific Crest Trail in sections, and that if he was going to do that, he needed to, you know, pay attention to the weight. And, you know, the other impetus was the young scouts. As we took them backpacking, we were a very active troop, a lot of backpacking trips. And, you know, you had these little scouts with these huge packs and huge weights. And we would, I remember one trip, there was this young kid, and we had some leaders go through his pack and sort it out and stuff. And so we're ready to go. And he's got his pack on, and he's carrying a huge black trash bag full of stuff. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, that's all the stuff that wouldn't fit in my pack. It's like, whoa, timeout. We're not ready to leave. We gotta do this all over again. I mean, he had a sledgehammer and, you know, I don't know how many changes of clothes, and because how else are you going to put stakes in, you know? So so it was a process. So I did my first Sierra trek with the scouts with our son Brian, my pack weighed over 70 pounds full with a week's worth of food and the tent and all that stuff. And I had just gone down to REI and said, you know, we're going to be a week in Sierra. So what do we need? And they had loaded us up with, you know, what everyone said you needed at that point. And the internal frame packs were like the new cool thing that they moved with your body instead of like the old Kelty external frame I had. And so that pack by itself weighed 7.5 pounds empty. And now when I go out, my base load of everything but food and water is usually around 5. So it weighs less than just the pack on that first trip. So based on, you know, Reed section hiking the PCT and trying to lighten the load for the young scouts, and looking at how heavy the pack was I had, I thought, well, I could start with sewing a pack. And so I ordered a bunch of material and sewed a backpack. And then as I hiked with that one, I thought, well, I can make this better. This could be a little smaller. This could be a little lighter. So I made a second pack. And, you know, eventually, I always tell people when they contact me and say, oh, I made myself a pack, I say, well, just be warned, it won't be the last one you make. Because inevitably, at least, and you can appreciate this, if you have an engineering mind, you're always thinking, like, how can I improve this? You know, how can I pare it down? How can I make it work better? So the fourth pack I made, which, I don't know, we just referred to it as the G4, because G was, you know, my initial for my first name. It was early internet days, and the word started getting out kind of on the ultralight forums, like, hey, you know, Glenn made this pack that's really light. So I drew the plans up and put them on the internet for free so anyone could make the pack if they wanted to, if they could make their own G4. And of course, it was only my size, so I don't know what short people or regularly sized people did, but, and every now and then I'm giving a talk and someone comes up with their old G4 that they made from way back in the day, you know, very well loved. And I love those meetings. It's just so cool. But I kept getting calls from people saying, hey, you know, I don't know how to sew and I don't know anyone that knows how to sew. Could you make a pack for me? At this point, I'm working 70 hours a week doing the engineering, constructing a pack, you know, from like measuring it out, cutting the fabric, sewing everything. It was about a 10-hour project. So that was an easy answer. No, I'm not going to make you a pack. But I kept getting inquiries, and I kind of felt bad for people. So I was talking to Quest Outfitters, a couple sisters, Kay and Kim in Florida, that I got the materials from. And they had some industry magazine, and they said, hey, you know, we see this advertisement for a cut and sew on the, at least on the West Coast. It's Seattle, so it's same coast as you. So I called up and talked to Monty, and he says, "Oh yeah, we've done outdoor gear and backpacks and stuff." And so I was great. So he said, "Our minimum order is 100. I says, "I only need about 25. I figured that everyone who was asking me for a backpack would have one, and I could go back to my engineering. So we talked back and forth and finally settled on 50, and I figured, okay, they'll be in my garage for the next 5 years, but I'll eventually get rid of them somehow. And then I mailed him up a pack and some materials so he could make one, and he looked at it, and I got an email from him, or we had a phone call, and he says, "These are not like the other packs we made." And I said, "Yeah, well, that's kind of the point. You know, they're different. They're lighter." Anyway, so he finally, our son Brian, put together a rudimentary website where people could, like, fill out an order form. And, you know, we put it out on the forum, I guess. I don't remember. And I started getting orders. So I grabbed a pad of yellow lined paper and started writing the orders down. And I still have those yellow lined pages with those early orders. And before I even got the shipment of the 50 packs, we had 86 orders. So that was my first inkling that I might have underestimated how many people actually wanted one of these things. And so, you know, I ordered more fabric, kept making packs and kept selling packs and shipping them out. And that was the start.
Now, part of this ethos of take less, it's obviously take less gear when you're out packing. And I think, you know, all backpackers and through hikers learn this. But in your book, you apply this to, you know, kind of a concept of life, which I found really interesting and something I hadn't thought of, but actually it really resonated with me. How can take less impact a person off the trail? Like, how can they apply that to their regular life?
There's a couple of applications. One is kind of along the lines of minimalism. We are, as a society, I think, so focused on more. And, you know, if I just had a little more, some studies show that most people, you know, they think if they had 20% more income, they'd be happy. That's what it would take to make them happy. And one thing about being in the wilderness with very little gear is you realize how little you actually need to be comfortable and safe in the outdoors. One of the benefits of that is to reset your gratitude, and gratitude's a great killer of envy and consumerism. And you know, we live such rich lives here in the United States compared to most of the rest of the world, and we take them for granted for a couple of reasons. One, it's just, you know, it's the way we live. So of course we have all this stuff. We have nice houses and temperature controls and clean water at any temperature we want, and soft beds with toppers, and, you know, all the 20 shoes and 5 jackets and all the stuff that we have. But there's nothing like a week of sleeping on the ground to reset your appreciation for the wonders of everyday living. You know, when you've been treating your water for a week and sleeping on a 3/8-inch foam mat on the floor, on the ground, you know, you get home and it's like, oh my gosh, showers anytime I want, you know, hot water at the flick of a wrist, potable water, you don't have to worry about where the next water source is. It's right at your faucet, probably multiple faucets in your home. And so it's a good reset as to, you know, appreciation for how good we have it. And part of that is when you take less in the wilderness, when you're carrying less load, you're better ability. You're more able to appreciate the things around you, for one, because you're not focused on, oh my gosh, my heavy pack. You notice the beautiful mountain view or that little stream that you might have walked by if you hadn't been carrying a lighter load. And you also have the ability, you're building in margin. You have the ability to help others. I was in Buckskin Gulch with my wife, which is rare because she's not a, hey, let's go sleep on the ground tonight kind of gal. But it happens. And her arthritis, she has super bad arthritis, and she couldn't carry her pack. So, you know, my pack, and because she's married to me, her pack, were both light enough that I could carry both of them. And I was still carrying less weight than most of the other people we saw in the canyon. And similarly in life, when you live on less than you make, you have the ability to impact others in a positive way. You have margin, be it time or money or attention, to impact the lives of others.
You know, I think that's so powerful. And you also talked about how you spend your time and what you focus on, and the idea of, you know, focusing on fewer goals means you're more likely to achieve them. And, you know, taking on fewer commitments with your time means you have more time to, you know, go and do something, you know, random, or just appreciate what you're doing. And that idea of take less, it really, I thought, was really powerful. But I can't let you go from this take less concept before talking a little bit about gear. And you're very kind. You share your what's in your pack in the back of the book, so that if people want to see exactly what's in Glenn Van Peskey's pack and how he gets down to 5 pounds, you can see that. But there's lots of backpackers and through hikers who are new or who are kind of stuck at a certain weight. And if you had one or two suggestions to people who are stuck, maybe they're stuck at 12 pounds, what are some easy wins or some ways to maybe get unstuck and find how to lower their pack weight a bit more?
Sure. And it's funny you said 12 pounds, because I have a distinct memory of being in Reed Miller's driveway, and we always weighed our packs right before we put them in the trunk and closed the lid, you know, as we were heading out. So you weren't tempted to put more bars in or an extra jacket or something like that. And I remember breaking 12 pounds base pack weight and how excited we were to be there. That was a while ago. I, you know, it's important for people to remember, I put a gear list in the book, and I have gear lists on my website, glennvanpeskey.com. And it changes based on the trip, because that's one thing. The more knowledge you have about the anticipated conditions, you know, the better you can hone the gear for that specific trip. But a lot of it also depends on your experience level. I actually just had someone reached out to me on Instagram the other day. They're getting ready to hike the John Muir Trail. And, you know, they've watched hundreds of YouTube videos to put together a gear list. But it really depends on your experience level. You know, if you are not comfortable yet setting up a tarp, well, then you probably should carry a little more traditional tent with segmented poles, because, you know, a light tarp, if you don't know how to set it up and pick a spot that it would be good for, isn't really gonna help. You're not gonna have a good time. So it's important to kind of keep your experience level in mind, and then always be pushing that. You know, hike with people that maybe have more experience with you, so you can see how they do it, or change one thing at a time. You know, I will often, there's usually something new I'm trying on a trip, but usually only one thing. Because, you know, if you try a bunch of new stuff and they all go wrong, well, then you can be in an unpleasant situation. So I would say, you know, some of the big ones, obviously, for looking at are your shelter, your sleeping bag, your sleeping pad, and your pack itself. Many people, they have a big pack because they want to make sure they have room for all their stuff. And it's like, well, in some cases, a smaller pack might help you make more refined decisions if you can't just put everything in. Sleeping pad, I know inflatable pads have gotten really light, but if you get adept at contouring the ground to match your back, you can get by with a couple ounces of very thin foam. So yeah, it just depends on what you want and, you know, picking up the skills. And I always tell people, for goodness sake, you know, try the stuff out before you get out there. I don't know how many times, you know, been on a trip and someone pulls a tent out that they hadn't set up before. And maybe there's stakes in it. Maybe there aren't. Maybe there's a ground cloth. Maybe there isn't. And sometimes it's missing one part that you were supposed to add, or it was defective, and which you would have known if you'd set it up in your backyard. So yeah, always practice at home before you actually get out there.
One part of the book talks about being willing to receive help, which is an area that I know I've struggled with. I think a lot of people struggle to, you know, accept help. Can you maybe talk a bit about why this is important?
Yeah, I mean, everyone has something. I can learn something from everyone. I mean, even if their base pack weight is twice mine, there's going to be some little trick that I'm going to pick up from them. You know, and maybe it's some amazing food thing that I hadn't thought of, or could be an attitude or a way of thinking about something that, you know, is going to be helpful to me. If you let go of needing to be the smartest one in the room, or if you're willing to say, I don't know, it's amazing what you can learn. There's an expression, it's amazing what you can achieve when it doesn't matter who gets the credit. And another exercise I like to do sometimes is to illustrate this similar idea is tell someone to put their hands up over their head, kind of palms facing you, and then I go up to them and start pushing on, you know, put my hands on theirs and start pushing. And the immediate response is to push back, you know, because that's what we do. Someone pushes, we push back. And the harder I push, the harder they push. And I say, okay, just observe that. And now you come up to me and push on me. And yeah, I put my hands up, they come up and they start pushing on my hands. And I maintain contact, but let my hands go back. And pretty soon their face is right in front of my face. And then they stop, they're off balance. You know, they stop pushing. And I said, did you see what happened? You know, when you resist, the other person presses harder. When you don't resist, then they stop pressing. And I think sometimes this can be applied to, like, say, taking help. You know, we want to resist. I'll do it. I'll figure it out. I know what I'm doing. And instead, if you just said, oh, that's interesting, tell me more, then we could all learn something.
Hey everyone, this is Richard, and I just want to take 30 seconds to let you know that if you are enjoying these stories and are interested in embarking on your own adventure, then head over to 10adventures.com. At 10 Adventures, our specialty is booking private and custom active holidays. Jump straight from dreaming to doing without any of the hassle of travel planning in between. Join thousands of other travelers who have already booked with 10 Adventures to destinations in over 85 countries and experience more of what our planet has to offer while making memories that'll last a lifetime. Now back to the podcast. You had a story just about how an older couple wanted to make you breakfast while you were cycling across the U.S. And, you know, you made a big deal, we don't want to inconvenience you. And I'm Canadian, and so we're famous for not wanting to inconvenience people. And that really resonated because there have been so many times in my travels where people have offered to do something nice. And I thought, oh, I'm just putting them out. I don't want to cause them, you know, undue, you know, effort or work. But I never kind of really thought, oh, hang on, they actually, you know, they're getting something out of this too. And I thought that was really, really well put. And, you know, again, for me, not thinking of people who are trying to help you, they're also getting something out of that at the same time as you getting something out of it.
And it's hard. I'm guessing that for you, when someone offers something and you say, no, you know, I don't want to put you out, what they're offering is something you would totally offer to someone too.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's my, you know, what I try and correct is like, well, wait, I would offer this. Like, you know, I have to take neighbors to the airport. And I can get up early and drive them to the airport. It's, you know, 45 minutes, not a big deal. And it's a great time to catch up with them. And they don't have to leave a car at the airport. And they don't have to hire some random Uber person and hope that they show up on time or shuttle. But people are really reticent to take me up on that. And so I have to remind myself, if someone offers me, to accept that. You know, it's like, well, I would do that. So yeah, I should accept that, because it's really not fair to only be giving and not letting other people give.
Yeah, I like the framework of, if I'd be willing to do that for somebody else, if they offer that to me, I should accept it, because, you know, that's just, it's almost like a polite thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I want to move on, because you talk a little bit about owning your own definition of success. And one of the most instrumental books in my life was written by a professor of mine, Clay Christensen, called How Will You Measure Your Life? And it was really this idea of measuring your, you know, what you want to achieve in your life. And it seems to me this owning your own definition of success had a big impact on you as well. Can you share how having your own definition of success, you know, impacted how you live your life?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, it's been a process, and it takes effort and kind of constant reflection and reminding. One of the early books I read was Better Off, and it describes I think he got his PhD or something, so this young man and his wife got out of MIT, graduated, and went to live for like a couple years among some people that the Amish consider kind of primitive. So very primitive existence, you know, no electricity. And you know, he describes, the thing that stuck with me is, I mean, it's, you know, it's an interesting book because they know nothing about living without all the modern, quote, modern conveniences. And so their neighbors have to kind of bring them along. And the thing that stuck with me is that he's talking about the process of doing laundry, which is like a day-long process when you're going out to the well and getting water and, you know, making the soap or whatever it was. But he said, you know, most people would look at that and say, well, that's ridiculous. You just buy a washing machine. And he says, okay, but to buy a washing machine, that would mean leaving my family and going to work somewhere in a city, doing something I may or may not like with people I may or may not like, to bring home money to buy a washing machine. He says, that's not really labor saving. That's not saving me time. It's just, instead of that time spent with my family at home in a relaxed manner, it's time spent somewhere else, working for someone else, doing something else in probably a more stressful environment. So, I mean, that was, to me, that segment of the doing laundry is like, wow, you really need to think about the overall, you know, how you live and how much freedom do you have, and are you spending your time in the way you want to spend your time? And there will be seasons. Like right now, I'm in a season of book promotion and I'm spending way more time than I would normally care to, you know, working on promoting this book and answering emails and sending things out and posting on social media and stuff. But I know it's just for a season, and so that's okay. And, you know, I'm meeting cool, amazing people like you. And so that's the fun part of that. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I have lots of friends who have kind of locked themselves into jobs they don't love because they bought a house and have a mortgage and have two cars and send their kids to private school. And, you know, they just seem so unhappy in life. But from the outside, they have, you know, phenomenally successful careers. But, you know, it's like this Amish example. They end up, you know, they prefer just to do something a lot simpler, not have this massive mansion and these nice cars, and just live a life that's more authentic for them.
Yeah, and I mean, the advantage of that is, you know, when you come towards the end of your working years, you know, you have less to kind of prop up. I mean, you know, if you're living in a million-dollar house and you're used to driving Audis and Mercedes, and it's like, well, all of a sudden, the income you need to support that level of life is a big nut to crack compared to, you know, if you're driving 10-year-old Subarus and renting a house somewhere, it's like, yeah, no big deal.
That kind of leads into another question. You mentioned hedonic adaptation. And can you maybe explain what that is and why it's important?
Yeah, so hedonic adaptation is getting used to kind of what we have. And the studies show, like I mentioned, most people think like if they had 20% more income, then they'd be happy. But the problem is as their income grows to that 20% and they get the nicer car, send the kids to private school, whatever was on their list, that becomes the new normal. And all of a sudden that's not new and special. And it doesn't, they lose the happiness. The happiness goes away. And then they go, well, if I only had 20% more money. I learned something fascinating. I just read Chris Anderson, the head of the TED Talks organization, his Infectious Generosity book. And he quoted studies. There's one that he was involved in and some other ones that were done where you gave people some money that they could either keep and spend for themselves or give away. And most of the people, you know, when it's unexpected money, they give a big chunk of it away. And then they measured the happiness that they got from giving that money away. And the generosity of giving money away made people happiness to a level equivalent to a doubling of their salary.
Wow.
And the kicker was there was no hedonic adaptation to the happiness gained by generosity. 10 years later, they were still happy about that generosity. Whereas the income is like, no, I'm not happy about that anymore. You know, I got bigger bills and everything else. So to me, I mean, that's like, you know, if we could be generous, we would be happier and it wouldn't go away like a winning the lottery or getting a promotion.
Yeah, all this stuff, you know, the answer out of anything you read, all this stuff doesn't lead to more happiness. It just leads to more, you know, more stuff. And, you know, the decision, which of your four coats you're going to wear on your backpacking trip? Well, actually, that's just more challenge. If you only have one coat, you just put it on. But if you've got a bunch of coats and a bunch of boots and a bunch of tents, it's not that it doesn't make your life better. It can make your life worse because you're adding more complexity to just what should be a really easy, simple decision.
Yeah, well, that's an area that we see. There wouldn't be enough evidence to convict me of being a minimalist, except unless you met me on the trail. Because since I started a gear company, I do have a lot of loaner gear in my gear basement. My personal stuff that I usually take, though, you know, I like to dial it in for the right conditions. So I do have more jackets than I need because if I think it's going to be warmer, well, I don't want to take that heavier jacket. I'll take the lighter jacket. So that's an area where I could definitely do better in.
At one point in the book, you talk about how going into nature frees you from the annoyances of modern living. Why do you think it's important to get away from, you know, quote unquote, modern living?
You know, because you don't have time in a typical, personalize it, I don't have time. You know, when my phone's dinging every few seconds, or I'm checking it to see if people are responding to my last post on LinkedIn. People are sending me interesting articles or things I want to read, which leads to other things. You don't get the uninterrupted time to just let your mind wander. And that's really, I I do some meditation every morning, and I suck at it because my mind's always like.
Everyone does.
I know. I'm sure somewhere there are people that just empty their mind, and that would be amazing. But I think the closest I get is probably, walking in the woods for days on end, because there's no internet, so you can't follow up on anything. You can't, you might wonder about something, but you're not going to ask Siri. And to me, there's no better way to empty your mind and just really think about, life and things and people that matter to you and, maybe tweaks you want to make to change your life and subtly in some areas. And it's so hard for me anyway, in front country life, to just get that uninterrupted time. Road trips are like one, it gets close. Drives my wife crazy because I could drive for 8 hours straight, not saying a word, no music playing, no nothing. Very happy, just in my own mind. But
you talk also in the book about how being content is almost like a countercultural thing to do in today's society. Can you talk a little bit more about contentedness just in life and how you achieve it?
Yeah, I think, there's so much focus on happiness, and it feels like, I heard something interesting the other day, the pursuit of happiness is in the U.S. Declaration of Independence. I think I heard something that that happiness back then was different than we think of it today. And it was more of and I'm not going to get this exactly right, but it was a thought of becoming more ethical and becoming a better person, basically, rather than I'm happy that we think of that today. So it was more of like a becoming better rather than like a becoming happy. But there's so much focus on happiness, and I feel like it's like a pursuit, like there's stuff we're doing and chasing after happiness. And, sometimes I wonder if we shouldn't just be focusing on being content where we are, finding the contentedness. I think when you're, when you're in the backcountry, yes, you're going up a hill and the sun's hot and your legs are sore and your hips hurt or whatever, but there's always something that you can appreciate there. I think of it like heat pumps. Heat pumps are kind of getting big here, to save energy. And it's a heat pump, even when it's, say, 40 degrees out. Sorry, I don't know the Celsius equivalent. Even when it's 40 degrees out, the heat pump can take what heat there is in the 40 degrees outside and concentrate it to heat your house to 68 or whatever you want. And I think that's an illustration of kind of our ability to find contentment and gratitude, something that we're thankful for, even when things suck, it's 40 degrees, there's still good in there. And if you focus on that, you can concentrate that and get contentment inside yourself.
You talk about the concept of, each of us can tell a life story that focuses on the negatives, and we can tell ourselves we've had a horrible life, or we can focus on the positives and tell ourselves we've had a great life. And I thought that was really, really powerful. I'm lucky. I am a super positive person, and I deal with adversity. Like, I can kind of look at the upside. But I know one of my sons isn't like that. And, for people who maybe aren't naturally disposed to looking at the positive, how can you help someone like that, focus more on here's all the good things, without, without kind of coming across When I told my son that, he just says, "Oh, Dad, you don't understand." But I'm interested, you know, how can people who don't think that way, how can they be helped?
Boy, I don't know. And that's, I'm sure there are many smarter people than me. You know, I was an anxious worrier growing up. And I think part of it is, there's probably some professionals like counselors and therapists could help. I think part of it is with age, you realize that a lot of the things you worried about actually turned out okay. And so you can apply that going forward. It's like, well, this looks bad and it could be bad, but, you know, based on looking backwards, it's like things generally kind of worked out. And so I'm going to trust that even though it looks bad, somehow it's going to work out and I'll get through it because I got through everything up to this point. But yeah, I don't know how, you know, how you could help people get to a better place on that, of less worrying and anxiety. Because anxiety is like a huge thing in our society. I don't know about Canada, but in the U.S., man, it's like rising levels of anxiety and suicide, depression.
It's I know with my kids, taking them into the backcountry for a few days and getting off devices, it definitely lowers anxiety. And we went and climbed a mountain here last week, and it's, you know, still winter, but, you know, we just had our micro spikes. And my oldest son was in a great mood for like 3 days. And, you know, we go downhill skiing, but that's different from, you know, actually like hiking and getting the body moving. And I, you know, maybe that is the answer of, yeah, this is actually, you know, what he needs is just to get away and get his body moving for 4 or 5 hours. And that's what's going to work out all the anxiety he has.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, I mean, there are plenty of studies showing about the, I think in Korea, they call it like forest bathing, is the translation for the word they have of, you know, spending time in nature. As you know, for them, it could be a park or doesn't have to be the mountains, but it just getting out in nature. I mean, there are plenty of studies that show the beneficial, effects of that. And anything that we can do to, you know, I know people that put away the devices on the weekend, don't look at them. I saw a hack the other day that I did on my phone that you can turn it to black and white.
Yeah, yeah, I do that. I tell my kids, I'm not paying for color this month.
That's awesome. Yeah.
But it totally makes it less addictive. Just you totally. Press the close button 3 times and it goes to black and white, and it's like incredible.
Well, mine's like default black and white. And you have to press the side button 3 times to turn the color on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I went back in and did little shortcuts for specific apps will come on in color. You know, like I'm looking at photos or something like that, comes on in color, but the default is black and white, and that, you know, makes it a lot less attractive.
Yeah, it actually is powerful. You talk a lot about the importance of relationships, and I was wondering how you see backpacking adventures specifically impacting relationships or maybe helping to build relationships.
It's, you know what, it's not backpacking per se, but we bought a Sprinter adventure van. It was my wife's idea. I did not think it came out of the blue. I did not think it was going to be a great idea, but it is an amazing idea, and we spend a lot of time together because even though we're both retired, we're both very busy. So, you know, at home, apart from like coffee in the morning and dinner in the evening, we're both like going in different directions and don't usually spend that much time together. But, you know, when we're on a road trip, we're together 24/7. And it's really valuable having that extra time just to talk about whatever, or to explore things together. You know, I do all the driving and we'll drive by something. And, you know, if we're wondering about something,
she'll check it out and go, well, let me tell you what I've learned. And I mean, we've been to the Jell-O Museum in Leroy, New York, which never would have happened, you know, was not on my bucket list for sure, but was a lot of fun. And so the wilderness, I mean, it can be great for time alone and reset, but one of the things I've really enjoyed, I've done kind of some of the last few years through my friend John Mackey, he does these kind of walking trips. And so someone's transferring the luggage and you're staying at, you know, huts or little hotels or something, but basically you're getting up and you're walking all day between towns or, you know, mountain paths. And he has an interesting group of friends. And usually in life, we don't really have time to get to know people. You know, it's kind of like, hey, how's it going? Even if you have time for coffee, it's like, okay, I got to go to my next appointment or whatever. You don't really have the chance. And so it's great when you're walking all day, every day. Your pace will bring you, you know, you find yourself walking next to someone for a while and you get to talking to them. And it makes me chuckle because I don't know how many times someone would say, you'd ask them something, they go, well, that's a long story. And it's like, well, we got nothing to do, you know, go for it. And they can talk, they can take the next 2 hours to tell you the story that they probably never get the chance to tell anyone, because where do you have that kind of time where you got nothing to do but walk? And the walking, you kind of engages your body and your mind enough that you can share and take the time to get deeper and really build those relationships. So, I mean, I'm close to some people in ways that that's rare because I spent days walking next to them.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think even just having the non-confrontational walking beside somebody, as you know, if you think if you go to eat, you're sitting across, you know, people are a bit more comfortable sharing things that maybe, you know, are just ideas or things they've thought of, you know, they're, you know, it's a different conversation than meeting for a coffee where you have 30 minutes and you're, you know, a topic to discuss.
Yeah.
You end the book with a chapter on saying yes, which just in your last, you know, answer, you talked about saying yes to a camper van, saying yes to go to the Jell-O Museum. How does saying yes, how does it change your life, or how could it change people's lives, do you think?
You know, and it's great to plan. I was actually having coffee with a friend the other day, and he was talking about, you know, what are your goals for the book and where do you see this going? I said, you know, this point in my life, it's like, I'm really just trying to do a good job and see what unfolds. And I have no idea where this will go. And that's part of the fun. I'm an engineer, so, I mean, I like to plan stuff. And, you know, there's obviously some things you need to put the planning in. But I really relish now just the unexpectedness of someone coming into my life, you know, our paths crossing, and just that anticipation, like, oh, you know, I wonder what this is about. Is this someone that is going to help me solve something I've been thinking about, or maybe I'm going to help them solve something they've been thinking about, or, you know, we're going to discover something about each other that we have in common, or we're going to collaborate on some future project. And it's always just exciting to, like, gosh, I wonder where this is going to lead. So it's fun. And now you have to, and I have a problem with this, you have to obviously use some discernment and discretion, because I have a bad habit of saying yes to too many things. And then you get back to not having margin. Then you don't have time for people because you're too busy with stuff that you said yes to. So I'm getting better, but, you know, my typical pattern is, like, I'll say yes to too many things, and then I say no to everything because I'm too busy. And then it's like, well, that looks interesting. And then I go back. But actually just did say yes to a couple things that I'm kind of wondering if that was a good idea, but we'll see.
We all do that.
Yeah.
Hey, Glenn, it was great having you on the podcast today. And again, I really enjoyed the book, and thanks for sharing a little bit more about it here in our chat. If people want to find the book or follow you, where can they find you?
Well, the book comes out April 16th, and it's available, online at Amazon or any of the online booksellers. It's available at Gossamer Gear. If you want, I think the first 100 are going to be signed by me, and your local bookstore can order it. So if you want to support your local bookstore, definitely do that. And I have a ton of other resources on my website. You can sign up for my every other week newsletter. I have a bunch of gear lists, some videos, if you want to kind of see what's in my pack. We've got some videos there kind of through the years. So that would be the main location for that kind of thing is glennvanpesky.com.
Excellent. Well, I'll put links to what Glenn mentioned in the show notes. And with that, thanks everyone for listening to this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. We'll be back next week to explore the world and hear about more epic adventures. Start planning your own adventure by visiting us at 10adventures.com and listen to other episodes of the 10 Adventures podcast on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you find your podcasts.